I got a letter to the 369 in September 1944 and flew some 33 missions until the end of the war, and was there for the Casey Jones Project until September of 1945. I became a lead pilot in January of 1945, and about a third of the missions I flew as a lead pilot. And it was great to be a lead pilot because you could fly an automatic pilot instead of working your tail off flying formation against other airplanes. I would tell you about one mission I flew and one other little experience I had. The mission that I talked about is on March 30th, 1945. And we were carrying what was known as Disney bombs. They weighed 4,200 pounds apiece, one under each wing. And we were going after submarine pens. These bombs were built by the British. They were rocket propelled, and they were doing 700 miles an hour when they hit the ground and could pierce some 26 feet of solid concrete. They had to be dropped at exactly 20,000 feet. We made the first run on the target. It was about 50% cloud cover that day, and unfortunately the bombardier lost the target at the last minute. So we had to make a second run. Well, on the first run they got our number two engine and did some other damage to the airplane. One piece of which we found on the second run when the bombs, it was a good run and the bombardier was on the target. But unfortunately, the bombs didn't release because they got the bomb release mechanism on the first run. So we made a third run, and unfortunately, he lost the target again, so we made a fourth run. It was the only time during the war that the lead airplane ever made four runs on the same target. And it was one of the interesting experiences. The more interesting thing that I think you would all appreciate is on May 2nd, 1945, there were no targets left to bomb. This is a week before the end of the war. And so we were delivering newspapers instead of bombs. And instead of flying with 1,000 other airplanes at 25,000 feet, we flew this all by ourselves right on the ground. And we flew on the ground because you were a little safer if there were some enemy fighters in the area, and there were still German fighters around. And we were dropping barrel-like containers of newspapers on parachutes. And our first target was Ludwigshafen, and after that we went on to the prison camp at Buchenwald that had just been freed some 3 weeks earlier. And it was probably one of the most emotional experiences of my lifetime. I flew around it for about a half hour or so, and there was the grave open with 1,000 bodies laying in it. And the survivors on the ground with arms like toothpicks waving to us. And it was just a remarkable experience. It was the perfect way to end the war, because how many people I killed or what kind of damage I did on those first 33 missions, I don't know, but whatever it was totally justified by what I saw that day. So that's essentially the highlights of my career.
No,
you don't have to touch anything. Just you can speak into it.
Okay. Well, that was pretty good, Walter. Walter, thank you for what you said. And I can understand a lot of what you might have been going through. I myself joined the 369th in October 1943, and more or less replacement for the Air Force. The 8th Air Force lost 60 airplanes on October 17th, and a raid on Schweinfurt, very popular. Well, I shouldn't say popular, but a very well-known mission. And you're talking 60 airplanes, you're talking 600 men. And we went in there actually to shore up what was left of the, of the 8th Air Force at that time. Anyway, I ended up at Thurlow, It was a ball turret, you know. And I had never been in a ball turret until I got to Sirleaf. I did the majority of my training in a B-26, which is the Marauder. It was a twin-engine bomber. I was a tail gunner on that most of my training. When I was shipped overseas, I landed in Scotland. In Scotland, I took sent us by train down to Sirleaf, and I was told I was a, since I was weighed 120 pounds, and I was about 5'8" maybe, and they ended up as a ball turret gunner. I flew, I think, about 14 missions at that point with that crew in a ball turret gunner. And one day when I was in on a three-day pass in London, I got back to the barracks late. When I wasn't, actually, I wasn't late. I was not due until 6 o'clock in the morning. I was there before that. But unfortunately, my crew had gone out on a mission, and I missed the flight. And as it would be, that would happen when I came back, when they came back, or when the mission game was over, waiting for the airplanes to come back, my crew didn't come back. They were shot down. And, hard to believe that after 60 some odd years, I still remember it. After a while, I wasn't looked upon too well by one of the senior officers, and I was put on a non-flying status for 3 months. And after about 3 months, we had another big loss, and they needed some replacement crews, and they put me back on flying status, but this time, I ended up as a Targhaleer. Targhaleer is drops the bombs, the same as a bombardier does, but he doesn't have the qualifications that a bombardier does. He doesn't need them, and I think the reason for that was that the Air Force decided, or the Air Corps decided, that they really didn't need to take an officer, train him for 6 months or so, and spend all that kind of money and put him in an airplane just to flip a switch. Well, they put us in as they created what we call a Targhaleer. My job with them was to drop the bombs and also to maintain the two guns in the nose. Well, I flew another 14 or so missions, and on my 28th mission on August 8th of 1944, we were on a low altitude bombing run in support of ground troops in Normandy invasion. This was like, I think it was like 6 or 8 weeks after the invasion, something like that. And we got shot down. And actually, we bailed out. And when we bailed out, when we first got hit, the number 3 engine was on fire. And was a pretty hot fire, and the four men in the back, the tail gunner, 2 waist gunners, and radio operator, they bailed out immediately. Being up front, they decided we didn't see the actual, we could see the flames, but not as much as they did. So about 1 or 2 minutes, or maybe even less, the pilot decided that we ought to go too. So we went out. And as it turned out, 4 of us landed in the territory that was like a neutral territory. It was German on one side, Allied forces on the other side, and we landed somewhere in between. And we rounded up together. 4 of us rounded up together. One of them, a guy by the name of Joe Brown, was the flight engineer. He didn't rendezvous with us, but I rendezvoused with the pilot, indicator, the bombardier, the navigator, Raymond Blocker, and the co-pilot, and I remember his last name, but I don't remember his first name for some reason. His name was Salmon, the co-pilot. And we jumped out, and when we got together on the ground, we eventually started to wander, and we ran into a Welsh infantry group, and they treated us pretty well, but they were going east and we wanted to go west. So they pointed us towards the American lines, which we eventually wound up with the Americans, and we sent back to England. Unfortunately, four guys who bailed out the first time, they ended up at prisoners of war until the end of the war. That's about the most interesting story I have.
Okay. Is that loud enough for everybody? Yeah. Okay.
Well, I started my flying with the 367 in December 29, 44. As was the practice at that time, and I think before my time, that a first pilot always flew a couple of missions as co-pilot with an experienced crew. This was to accustom you and your crew members who are doing the same thing with other crew to the rigors of a combat mission. Unfortunately for me, on my first mission, the first pilot was hit by flak and a thigh damage, but enough to take him out of his seat for first aid. So I was flying then as first pilot until he got back under control. We had lost so much gas from flak damage to our tanks that we knew we couldn't get back. And we limped across the channel and made a forced landing. At that time, I didn't even know what it was, but it was a large landing area on the south of England. Paved and laid out explicitly for this kind of landing. You could land in any direction there. We stayed overnight. Two mornings later, I was in the same position, second co-pilot. This time, we lost our gas tanks over target. We didn't have enough gas to get back. And so the pilot took us into an emergency gassing field in reoccupied by Americans area of France. I remember Captain Butterfield, who was operations officer. He patted me on the back after that second mission and said, "Well, boy, you got them all out of the way now. It's going to be easy." About our sixth mission, now I'm flying with my own crew, when we came back, it was our fourth mission, Butterfield said, "You know, we've been doing some research on your crew. You're all from different states, and the finance department of the states wants to go do a repeat of the Memphis Belle on a bond selling tour. So we're going to assign you to a very famous plane called the Rose of York." So we flew the Rose of York then for several missions. And on my 15th mission, which was February 3rd, we were reassigned because I had been training in lead positions, and our squadron was leading the bomb group, and I was flying deputy lead. Consequently, I couldn't fly the Rose, which was kind of sad because this was our big chance to go to Berlin. Everybody had been waiting on that because we knew that the Germans had pulled back so far that all of the administrative staffs and the people who were really running the Nazi operation were now housed right in Berlin. But the rose, with Butterfield said, you're not flying the rose because this is the rose's last mission, and then it's going to go in for Repo Devil. Will be completely overhauled. By the time that's done, you guys will have finished your tour and back to the States. Really sounded good at the time. And he said, oh, well, we're putting a BBC correspondent on the rose because it's her last mission. And of course, the English had a very fondness for this particular plane. We, over Berlin, we got hit very badly with flak. We lost our Tokyo tanks. The tail gunner was hit by flak and lost his wrist. And the Mickey egg that was in the place of the ball turret could not be retracted. And our 2 and 3 engine were gone. We couldn't feather the number 3 engine just so we batted out there windmilling. Got a call from radio saying I can't use the radio, the compartment's filled with gas. He was afraid of ignition. Seconded. The West called and said, we have no oxygen. The oxygen system is out. Put everybody on walk-around bottles. My engineer said, we've got probably 40 minutes of gas left. Asked the navigators, can we get out of Germany? We didn't care where we were going, but we wanted to get out of Germany. And he said, maybe we can make the coast. So we started. Now, we had lost about 10,000 feet with the initial hit. And we just couldn't maintain altitude. And we were down at that time to about 12,000 feet, and the oxygen had run out. Well, by that time, everybody was fairly safe. Got a call from the engineer who was in the top turret, and he said, there's an ME-109 on our tail. So we decided that if he could get a shot at it, or if the waste gunner could get a shot at it, we'd wait for him to come in. But he just sat back there, and we're limping our way out, feeling that if he hits us, we're goners. We got right to the coast, and at that time we were at 8,000 feet, and we're now going out over the North Sea. So we set up to ditch, got everybody ready for that, and wondered why this ME-109 didn't come in for the kill. So the curiosity, what's wrong with this guy? We were about halfway to the coast of Sweden, over the North Sea, and he started moving in. At least that's what the waste gunner and the top turret gunner observed. And he would keep moving from side to side. He came in on the left side, and then he swung underneath us and up on the right side, as if he was really looking for something. When we were 15 miles from the Sweden coast, we were met now by 3 Swedish fighters. And the Swedish fighters would like to show us that there was a place to land. And we made an emergency landing, breaking the Mickey ball off of the big billow because we couldn't get it up. And it was on the frozen marshes south of Malmo. These frozen marshes go as far as a mile out into the water. We just got nicely in and thought we've made it. In spite of all the racket with the ball or the Mickey being torn off below it, and we thought it was our left wheel gear went down because the plane went over on its left wing. what it was, we found out later, that we had, on this frozen marsh, there were pits, and they had a sheet of ice over them. And the weight of the plane was just too much, and it broke, and that side of the plane went down. We asked the Swedish people that met us with machine guns about the ME-109. And with his, he didn't speak English, but we got the idea that the 109 was following us to get to Sweden. And he was a deserter. It came out in the newspapers later that he had his wife and his mother-in-law in the ME-109, and to do that he had torn out all of his navigational instruments. So he wanted somebody to guide him there, and we didn't know that's what we were doing. And my stay in Sweden was not unpleasant. Boring. And out of boredom and complaining about it, I did get an assignment to the air attaché's office at the American Legation headquarters in Stockholm. This is really good. Well, it was good up until the time the war ended, when all of the internees were sent home. Kessler would not release me. So I was there for another 3 months after the war was over. And I came home to marry my bride. That's about the story of my career.
Let's give them a round of applause, please. Now, Ron mentioned the Rose of York, and the BBC correspondent was on board. What he didn't mention was that it was hit and was never seen again. So all hands were lost, including the BBC correspondent. And this is one of these kinds of things that this 306 Bomb Group Association is kind of interesting, the connection to students who work as interns on behalf of the association at my university. I don't know if any of you in the room was at the reunion in Fort Worth in 2000, what was that, 9, I guess. One of the interns that was there working on your behalf was Katie Bernard. Katie is now a graduate. She has her master's degree. She is now an official with a museum in New York City, doing a lot of things. But while she was at ACU, she produced and directed a short film on the Rose of York. And it's a very moving thing. It's only about 5 minutes long, but she did the research, and it tells the story of the Rose of York. We also have, I don't know if is George in the room yet? Is he here yet? George Roberts.
He may not be able to make it. If he makes it at all, it will just be for Saturday night.
Oh, that's right. You told me that.
Saturday night.
George was there on the ground at Thurlai the day that Princess Elizabeth came to christen that bomber.
I remember that day. Oh. He had a parade, and they came in. First of all, they painted red roses on there, and they were the white roses in the English history. So they had to cover up those red roses and paint white roses on there.
Well, we may want you to be on the panel tomorrow. We'd like to know about those roses.
Okay.
and all of your other memories about that day. It would be maybe nice to put you on Saturday in case George is here. The two of you being on the ground at Thurlai the day that happened, that would be very, very interesting indeed. So we have a lot of connections with the Queen, the present Queen today, with some of our people who were connected in some way to the Rose of York. And of course, these other two men were there, and the Princess was around during those times as well. I don't know if any of you remember Peg Hoppe, who hasn't been to a reunion in the last couple of years, but she was the director of the Red Cross Club at Thurlai, and she was in charge of doing a reception for the King, the Queen, and Princess Elizabeth that day. And I interviewed her in San Antonio a number of years ago, and she tells the story. It's very interesting. But she said that she was sitting there chatting with the Queen Mother, who was the Queen at the time, and the Queen had to explain that, you know, yes, we were glad to bring Princess Elizabeth, but we left Princess Margaret home because we didn't think she would behave. So even during World War II, they were having trouble with Princess Margaret, and continued to have problems with her for the rest of her life. So it was really kind of interesting. Well, let's open it up.
If I could just add a little bit to that lore.
Take the mic.
This is part of the history that Captain Butterfield indoctrinated us with. But originally, that plane was not named the Rose of York. Its original name was the Princess. And the British intelligence objected strongly. They felt that it would be too big a coup for the Germans to shoot this plane down and be able to say they shot a member of the royal family, so to speak. So it was Elizabeth's father and mother that said she had many lesser titles other than princess. Why not the Rose of York?
Okay, any questions from the audience? Cliff.
For either the pilots, Mr. Rosetta, Mr. Listener, you were talking about lead pilots, and I understand the concept of a lead pilot for the squadron and for the group. But there was, in going through some of the materials, the research materials, they have assignments where they assign people as flight A group leader, flight B group leader, flight D, etc. What was it? What did that mean, being a flight leader of one of these Alpha, Bravo, or Charlie flights or whatnot?
Well, in a squadron, you had six planes in the lead, and then a high flight and a low flight. And you had, in the group, you had the lead squadron, the high squadron, and the low squadron. So it was, the flight was just three planes flying off the lead airplane in each squadron.
Okay. And
you want to comment on that, Ron?
Well, only that the terms that you hear, you were flying group lead or squadron lead. And of course, I never flew anything other than deputy to both of those, and it was at the group lead, which was for the whole bomb group rather than just my squadron on my last mission.
And I might add also that you had lead and deputy mission lead as well when the group was detailed to lead the whole mission, the whole bomber stream. And so in that context, they had not only their group, but behind them, they had other bomb groups in the wing that's going on the mission. And this deputy lead, at whatever level that person is serving, something happens to the group lead, then that person and his plane steps into that position. Some of you know about my uncle being killed not far from Thurlai with the 381st. And that morning, the deputy mission lead, a person who was a captain, bumped the co-pilot of my uncle's crew, and he was in the right seat that morning when they took off. 30 minutes later, they all bailed out, and my uncle went down with the plane. If they had made it to Peenemünde, and something happened to the lead, my uncle's crew would have moved into that lead position. So they had it all sort of covered as much as they could. You have something else to add? Okay. Good question, Cliff, because it's an important factor in the way the operations of a mission was sort of laid out. And of course, you selected people who were proven good pilots, but more than that, that could fly formation, and that was a key. And you had to have your group, a bombardier had to be somebody that could hit the target and so on. So there was a competition, really, in terms of assessing these crews, who could be elevated up to these leadership positions on the mission and enhance the possibility of success over the target. And of course, that was the key to the whole thing. Questions? Yes?
This is for Philip. We're talking about the Cavalier. Once they started the lead bombardier program, did the bombardier still control the plane when the bombs were being dropped with the Norden bomb site? You know, they
bomb site through the plane.
Bomb site
through
the plane.
That's a good question. That's
so
a good.
Even with the Cavalier still.
No, that's a good question. The Cavalier had no pilot training whatsoever. Now, what we do, my whole job as a Cavalier is very important. All I do is watch the lead airplane, and when they dropped, I dropped.
It was only the lead bombardier, who actually made the bomb.
The lead bombardier was in the leading ship, and there's 18 planes to the group. There's six high, six middle, six low, or six lead, six high, six low, and the lead bombardier is the one who everybody drops off. And when he drops, everybody else drops. And when the Air Corps figured out that they didn't need experienced bombardier to do all this, they eliminated the bombardier.
Would you also arm the bombs, et cetera?
Yes, you had to know enough about the bombs in order to monitor the loading of the bombs and setting up pulling up the wire out of the bombs to pull out the diffusers, so you activate the fuses. That was part of it. And I had the reason they had picked me for Cavalier is I had armament training prior up and also be in gunnery school. So I had a little advantage when they gave me the job at Cavalier. But no, Cavalier had nothing to do with flying the airplane. He was capable because the bomb site was still in the airplane. So the bomb site actually
the bomb site controls
the pilot. The pilot turns the airplane over to the bombardier, and the bombardier controls that for me.
So when did that lead bombardier program begin? My dad was a bombardier, and his last mission was March 6, 1944. So would he have been following the lead?
Yes.
Yes.
But he still was using the Norden bomb site. I mean, would...
If he was a bombardier, he was.
No, but he was a lead bombardier.
He wasn't the lead.
Then he wasn't using the
bombs. But there was a Norden in there.
No, but he didn't use it.
He didn't use it like he had been taught.
No.
Did that ever occur where each bombardier was dropping their bombs?
Yes.
Yes.
So when did that end?
And I'm not sure at what.
Just having gone through researching, I have one of the papers lying in there was done at the end of the war. Jimmy Doolittle had commission, but basically, 1942 to the very beginning of January of 43, the first runs they were doing were dropping individually, and then Curtis LeMay came up with the lead aircraft, lead bombardier, lead navigator concept. They started flying that way, and so basically, sometime in early 1943, they actually started flying and dropping on the lead plane, and at least from what it says in these papers here.
Well, Doolittle didn't take over until the beginning of 43.
No, I'm just saying he's the one that had commissioned this report that I read. It's a 39-page report.
At the end of the war, that's when he did that.
How it evolved from the six plane formations where they were, each individual bombardier was dropping, and Curtis LeMay was the commanding officer of the 305th
yes.
bomb group, I believe it was. And he started experimenting, and by early January of 43, they were this was evolving where they were dropping off the lead aircraft.
By the way, that report that Cliff is referring to is going to be one of those documents that will be very soon in the big group of documents we're uploading on the web, and so it'll be there where you can download. I think it's 39 pages, and it'll be interesting because it'll give you sort of a concise kind of overview of the the pattern of fighting the war from the 8th Air Force perspective, and there'll be a lot of other things as well. Questions? Philip?
No, I wanted to ask Walton Ron. I don't really remember whether the Tagliere opened the Bombay doors or not. I thought I remembered, yes, that we did open, because I remember when we jumped out, they opened them. Yeah. But, yeah, there was one other job that Tagliere had, another switch he had to pull.
Okay, Cliff, this is your third question.
I know.
And after that, you'll be paying $5 to the fund for...
Well, no. Just give me all that information before I come up with these questions.
Okay.
Fine. But this is actually somewhat different. In researching my own uncle, at various times he flew like 7 out of 10 missions in 1 month. And then he went for a month without it. And I know that you got leave. You can take leave to London and other places like that. But also, how did they come up with the assignment of who was going to go on a particular mission on a particular crew? You were with a crew, but the gunners would change, and about the only people that seemed core were the pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, and navigator.
Well, let me respond to that, and you may have some ideas as well. I did an interview with a man in the 381st Bomb Group who was in operations. And in that interview, he said that as the war went on, it sort of grew heavy on them because one or two of them were the ones that were having to plug in the spots. In other words, when it was determined that the mission was on, how many planes they needed, and what crews were available, then they had to start selecting people for replacements if this guy's on pass or this guy's sick or whatever. And they picked some names and they woke them up, put them on the thing, and then they went and they were killed. As the war went on, some of this really grew very heavy on them. So I'm assuming that the crew assignments are going to be made in operations in that evening when they get word that the mission is on and they have an understanding of how many planes they can put up and that kind of thing. I assume that line pilots are not going to come into play. You're awoken at the same time as the rest of the crew. Anybody have any comments on that question?
I would just comment that I was eventually assistant operations officer of the 369th, and the operations officer, in general, the night before the mission, selected the crews one at a time and the place that they were flying. And that then was given to the administrative people, and they woke them up at 4 or 6 in the morning, whatever. And that's how it was done.
So they didn't know until that morning that they were
going? Well, they knew that they might fly because they had to be there, but they did not know that they were going to be on the mission.
Until they were awoken.
Yeah.
Rumor has it that they got real eggs on them when they were flying mission that morning, as opposed to powdered eggs. I don't know. That's what I heard.
Now Walt's getting kind of hacked because he didn't get them, and he's wanting those eggs now that's due him.
The only thing we ever got in the morning was green eggs. Don't believe that powdered eggs.
Any other questions back there?
Back to the Norden bomb site. Somewhere I read that during the bomb run, they had to be flying very straight and level. And once the control of the plane was handed over to the Norden bomb site, is that what its purpose was, to hold the plane straight and level? Or one of its purposes?
The bombardier's job, when he took over control, the pilot turns the bomb site over, the airplane over to the bombardier, which means that the pilot gives the, he activates the bomb site. And the bombardier has a toggle switch on the bomb site that he can control the airplane with. His purpose is to try to put the Corsairs on the target. There's an automatic, it's an automatic pilot, but he has an override toggle here, an override toggle switch. Yeah, but no, that's, he doesn't, it's not hands flying.
But he's sort of guiding the crosshairs, trying to get the pinpoint the position for the drop, so he has to be able to control the airplane. Okay. But I'm assuming that the bomb site is sort of like an automatic pilot with that override on there and his ability to do that.
Yeah, the bomb site was actually tied into the automatic pilot, and it was in control of the airplane, so that as he moved the knobs on the plane would turn or it would go straight. He didn't really control the altitude. The pilot controlled the altitude.
Okay, am I correct, though, that for the final run before the bombs were dropped, the plane was at a steady speed and flying level?
I didn't quite hear that.
And the final moments before the bombs were released, am I correct in assuming that the plane had to be flying at a fairly steady speed and flying level?
Well, it should be, but the bombardier, if he made a correction just before the bombs were to drop, the plane might well be sideways.
Okay.
He was in control, so whatever the bombardier was doing is what controlled the position of the airplane.
Okay.
Let me also just mention something about the Norden bomb site. Of course, it's very top secret, and they're very careful to control that. In training in the United States, when the bombardier would go check out his Norden bomb site, he would be accompanied to the plane often with MPs with 45 automatics on their side. I went out to Paiute. Some of our bomb group people trained at Paiute out in the desert of West Texas. Went out there to shoot some footage for a film that I'm producing. And right behind where the hangars used to be, just some part of the walls are still standing out there in that desert sun, there is a whole row of buildings. Now, the buildings are gone, and they've just rotted away. They weren't dismantled. But in those buildings were bank vaults, and in the bank vaults is where they kept the Norden bomb sites. And the MPs and the bombardier would go to this building and check out a bomb site, and then they would accompany him to the perimeter track and on aboard the plane, and then they were there to meet him when they came back from the training mission. Well, today, standing out there in the hot desert sun is this row of building foundations, and standing on top of each one is a bank vault still there in the sun. Questions?
Bernard, have you finished that video, that CD about Europe?
That one will be coming out in probably the next 2 weeks. It's almost ready to be released. Any other questions? Good session. Good session. Okay.
Thank you, Ben.
See you tomorrow.
They'll be down here to sign autographs.
My little friend there. It was me.